Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello and welcome to the Hawk Week podcast. Today I'm with landscape architect Tom Liddell, trustee of Brogdale Collections, and I'm Matthew Appleby, editor of Hawk Week. So welcome, Tom.
Thanks very much, Matt. It's great to be here.
Now, Tom, there's lots going on with the Brogdale Collections, so can you tell me what's happening and what the Brogdale Collections are?
Ah, well, Brogdale Collections is the charity, completely independent, completely self-funded, which gives access to the National Fruit Collection at Brogdale near Faversham in Kent. And the National Fruit Collection is important because it's a national collection, but it's also of international importance under the Food and Agriculture Organization, which is called probably the UN, wonderfully named Treaty for the Conservation of Plant Genetic Resources for Food and Agriculture, aka the Plant Treaty. And so it's got 4,000 varieties, cultivars, shall we say, of apples, pears, plum, cherries, and a few quince, medlars, and it's got some suitable varieties of grapes, which for winemaking in Britain, and that sort of thing as well. And so we think it's the only one in the world of all the international ones, which includes, you know, potatoes and rice and all sort of, you know, cocoa, vegetable crops and everything else. We think it's the only one which is actually open to the public, probably because it's the only fruiting collection, even of the fruit ones, for historical reasons. And so we've actually got the attraction of actual fruit for people to see when they come. Difficult to see how you could regularly open a collection of wheat or something like that, really.
So it's a very valuable collection and you look after it, but at the moment this thing is happening. So what is happening?
It is, just to say, it's looked after on behalf of DEFRA by University of Reading, who are the curators. So we just do the public access and we're developing education programmes, et cetera, around it. Because with the diversity of fruit and all the things about diet and all those things which are being talked about and sustainable and, you know, how much balance between plants and meat that people can eat and all that sort of thing, there's a huge agenda that we can develop the educational side. But in terms of what's happening now is that the farm, the whole farm is 150 acres, 60 hectares up for sale, of which a third is the National Fruit Collection. And it's up for sale. DEFRA's got a secure lease on it. We've got a lease on it as well, on part of it. But it's up for sale because the owners have decided to sell. And it's now on the market.
Okay. So what does that mean, depending on who buys it?
What does it mean with...
What does it mean for the collection?
Well, DEFRA's got a secure lease on it. It's a long lease. I'm not sure how much is left. I've forgotten now, probably 25 years or something like 20. But the collection should be secure, you know, particularly it's got international status with the FAO. And so that's, I'll say it's only about a third of it, and there is the balance of the farm as well. So it puts us, of course, now in, we've got to, you know, hope we get on with the new landlords.
No, well, that's good news. And you've got plans for developing the site, haven't you, for some planning permissions that are in?
Yes, we have had for a long time, and I got involved in 1989 when the whole collections and everything was threatened and the farm was going to be sold. And of course Prince Charles got in and enabled the purchase of the farm and all that sort of stuff. But then it moved on from that. And eventually I actually found that the current buyers, when it was up for sale, and that was by far the best offer, which was there. So they bought it, the developer I knew. And so they're now, you know, like age, like me, of course, well, I better move on. So they've decided to sell. And that's the situation now. And it's on a website at the moment, so you can see all the details.
Oh, yeah. So you're hoping to build new attractions there in the future?
Yeah, I developed plans, in fact, even as much as the mid-90s, that we should try and show off sort of 10% of the collection in gardens, which would actually put them in their historic context of, you know, gardens of whatever period you might like. Of course, let's take a shining example, of course, of a little mini bit of Versailles, for instance, of course, which is, you know, showing off everything, to other gardens, more recent gardens, Victorian kitchen gardens and all those things. So we could actually show some of the historic cultivars in their actual context, much like a museum, actually, where 90% of their accessions, of course, are in storage.
No, indeed, because we were in touch quite recently about Peter Thoday talking of Victoria Kitchen Gardens, who I wrote the obituary for The Guardian. And I guess that is, you know, that piece of history is much loved by Britons.
It is. And I think that, it's a historic heritage position, of course, the big hitters in heritage and landscape and gardens, of course, are the National Trust and the English Heritage. And we've got a slightly... it's a bit rather complex situation. Of course, we're never great with getting the message out what you're about. But it's a very complex situation of what we're offering, what our position is. We don't get any outside funding, and although we have some generous charities which help us. But otherwise, no other sort of official funding at all. So we've developed these ideas, which we haven't really started to implement. You've got to hit a certain level where you can afford, as you know, of course, in anything to do with public horticulture of any kind, you've got to be able to afford the management and the maintenance. So you've got to hit a certain threshold. And of course, some of the most skilled horticulture there is, of course, is the management of fruit trees.
No, indeed. Now let's go back to the beginning, because you obviously been a landscape architect for many, many years, but you're from quite an artistic background, aren't you, Tom? You've got a well-known name in the art world.
Oh dear, right, yeah. Thank you for that, Matt. Yes. Yeah, indeed, I was actually brought up in a post-war environment in central London of artists who were, needless to say, in the sort of world of post-war idealistic art. You know, I remember the Artists International Association, that sort of thing like that. And my father was a printmaker, primarily a printmaker, and taught at the Royal College of Art. But that was all a bit too much, really. My mother ended up painting portraits. And so I thought, So my version of a 1960s rebellion was to go the other way, go from art into actually I took a pure science degree.
Ah. And where did it go from there? Because you didn't become the botanist or the biologist you might have been.
I didn't, no. I think I really... It was a wonderful experience to go on a really high-powered sort of genetics... plant breeding focus with all the other things of ecology and, you know, taxonomy and all that sort of thing there in the department as well. But I wanted to do plant breeding. That's why I did it. And I sort of had a possibility of going to Botanic Garden in Jamaica to breed citrus fruits. But then I thought, towards the end of the third year, I thought, I'm not sure I'd be a very good scientist. And perhaps, you know, he would find something. Then up came this thing. This is called landscape architecture, or landscape design, as it was so often called then. So I did a postgraduate in that. And then not long afterwards, I began to combine ecology and landscape architecture.
So you didn't go to Jamaica, you went to Manchester instead.
I went to Manchester, yes. Yes, yeah. I swapped tropical rainstorms for Manchester's drizzle.
Excellent. But you're quite a pioneer in ecology and landscape architecture. Would you say that's a fair description?
Well, yeah, I mean, I sort of expressed opinions about these things. I'm actually rather sad that, because very quickly I was in a position where I was able to combine ecology and landscape architecture. And so the idea of ecology and design to me, is probably the fundamental to what I've done ever since I've worked as a landscape architect. Because the whole, if you think about pure design, you know, you can think of very purist design in very small spaces, and it does all sorts of fun things and engages people and all that. But if once you then get into a wider world, wider landscape, you need to think about ecology as well, because particularly now, I mean, we're now in sort of, well, really, the sort of disaster zone of biodiversity and, well, possibly even of human survival, of course, if it's not, that's not repaired very quickly. You know, biodiversity is not just about, oh, isn't it nice that we're saving that butterfly, or in terms of botany, we're saving that rare plant, or, you know, reintroducing them or whatever. It's much more about if that system isn't there, it's exactly the same for in the wild as growing crops, of course. You know, as you know, any kind of crop, you know, whether it's ornamentals or whether it's food, whatever it is, the same systems, you know, it's just growing plants.
What do you feel have been the most important projects you've worked on over the years?
Ooh, I don't know, probably. I worked for Kent County Council between 74 and 84, and I was really lucky to be. They had two very large land holdings, and they put together a sort of mini team, really, a very mini team compared to the new towns, which are, you know, Milton Keynes was quite new then and all that. And one or two others were doing, Hampshire was doing something similar as well. And on that team, and I was very lucky because there was a very sort of entrepreneurial, open-minded surveyor who ran the team, a very, very small team, and an architect planner who actually studied with Ian McHarg in Pennsylvania, of course, which was wonderful because we instantly spoke the same language. You know, Design with Nature had been published in 64, I think it was 65. And so we were in, one of the developments was in about 350 acres, of what was essentially woodland. It probably wouldn't be considered for development. So I thought, okay, let's make the urban fringe of Chatham. And so we sort of said, okay, let's create the whole thing as though it's development. It's perfectly ordinary housing development, but within woodland. And that the open spaces, lots of chalk dry valleys, which will be there, will just be, you know, managed. That's it. It's an urban park, but it doesn't look like one. And it's pretty much like that now. Awful lot of trees there. So I sort of rather pioneered keeping trees in development by producing plans in the brief for each area that was done and said, you know, keep these trees, these are the good ones, and that sort of thing. So an awful lot of it's like that, and planned around existing trees with these larger areas of woodland and on the steep valley sides of the chalk valleys, etc. There. So that was one. And the other one at the same time was completely different in Ashford, which was then and still is an expanding town, which was arable land mainly, with the River Stour, which runs through Ashford, in one corner of it. So, you know, it was wonderful to have that huge contrast. And because the approach we took started to create much, much higher land values within a couple of years, everybody left us alone, of course, as long as it was making money instead of being, you know, costing the county council a lot of money, and we were just left alone.
So that was
it's the biggest impact. I mean, it's quite nice when you look on Google Earth and say, goodness me, that's all on Google Earth, you know.
That sounds great. It sounds ahead of its time, certainly. But looking where we are now, what do you think of the landscape architect profession at the moment and how it's represented sort of nationally and internationally?
It's kind of a leading question, that, isn't it, Matt?
Yeah.
As we know. Lots of things going on with the Landscape Institute. I don't really know. I haven't really looked at the press and things to see how much of it's been actually out there. But it's caused a lot of controversy within the profession. Well, I'm not sure if you can call it a lot of controversy, but it's all been going on. It's all very sort of administrative. But it's rather sad, really, because I think the real issues for the Landscape Institute, which after all includes designers, managers and ecologists, landscape scientists, is how's it going to, what are its members going to be doing in the wider world? And it includes those things that we were talking about, like biodiversity and all of those things, of course. But this not as jargon, but it's completely integrated into the design process. Because it's not that complicated, really, to understand it as a design feature, what you do with it. But as far as I can see, it's sort of talked about, but it doesn't really seem to be, well, from the scant knowledge I have, of course, is now, but it doesn't really seem to be integrated. You know, the funny thing is, I just reminisced in 1986, and I remember the date. There was a Future of Landscape Education conference in, I think it might have been Sheffield, I can't remember now, maybe Birmingham. And I chaired a group on ecology and design and made specific recommendations to attribute at least one major project in a landscape architecture course which integrated ecology and design and used the idea of, you know, habitats, etc., integrated into things at all scales. And I don't really believe that ever really happened. I think even at Sheffield, really, again, from, you know, not deep knowledge of it, but it's there should be a complete integration of ecology and design for most projects. I mean, after all, you've got biodiversity net gain now as part of the planning process. It is an absolute box-ticking exercise with lots of calculations on it. But does it actually mean anything? From what I've seen of it and what I've done with earlier things and all that, it may not. You know, rather like, you know, all these carbon schemes and all these kind of things, credits you can get, all that sort of thing, which are now being exposed for, you know, actually, yeah, there's always a way around them, you know, so they'll mean something, but do they actually mean anything what they're supposed to mean? And I have a fear that biodiversity net gain is going to be like that. It's a big process. It's lots of, you know, numbers crunching and all that kind of thing, measuring areas. But what does it actually mean? And that's really a much simpler process than all of that. You can use a lot of common sense if you really understand the basis of design and ecology.
Yeah, okay. No, that's interesting to hear. Now, how do you feel that landscape architects should be or would like to be represented at the moment? Like, what do they want to be heard to be saying, do you think?
Well, you know, it's become, since I first started working in 1969 in the London Borough of Lambeth, which I must say was great fun, led by John Medhurst, another, who writes, by the way, a very entertaining Tales of a Tree Spotter in the Arboricultural magazine, with extraordinary breadth of references and about a particular tree. And he was leading it then, and so that was great. And he was originally a horticulturist at Kew. And it's moved on in a very strange way, in the sense of it's become, obviously, huge numbers of landscape architects. It's become entrenched in the planning system, in lots of aspects of guidance and all that sort of thing. So whereas we were sort of, when I went out on my own in 1984, you had quite a job to make your voice heard on a multidisciplinary team for a developer or whatever. It now is rather different to that. And, you know, I've done a few schemes, doing just a little bit of work now, but particularly when my previous year was much younger, partner in the practice left and went out on her own, we were doing some quite significant landscape-led schemes, which is now the sort of what they should be, really, into quite sensitive situations. And one of them I'm still doing a bit of work on, and she's doing quite a lot of work on. And that's the way it's really changed, I think, is it's got into the system. But the question is it contributing now with, you know, totally integrated into a professional system, administrative system, box-ticking system? Is it really delivering what it should be? And I've just been reading the late edition of Landscape, the Landscape Institute magazine, on the train coming up, and I'm not sure.
Well, that is the big question indeed. Now, what are you working on at the moment and in the future? What plans have you got professionally?
Well, one or two bits of tail end landscape. Quite difficult, really, funnily enough, to when somebody calls up and says, what about this? I've got phase two or something, to say no. Your sort of instinct is still to say yes. Oh, it's another site to go to, you know, to look at, and what are the challenges? But the most interesting one is a marina in Strood in Kent, which is across the river from Rochester, and it's about a kilometre of riverside. And it's a really interesting client who just bought it as a derelict place sort of over 25 years ago, mud flats and rotting wooden wharfs and all that thing. And he's turning it into a sort of, not just a sort of flashy marina, but with boatyards and dry docks and all that sort of thing there. So it's rather fun to be involved with people who just enthusiasm and want to get going. And of course, lots of landscape issues. The area of outstanding attribute is each side of the River Medway there. And yes, and we also came across many years ago one of the projects there, Tentacle Lagoon Worm in saline lagoons, which unfortunately I got to know a lot more about than I would have really wanted to.
Really? What happened there?
It's only maximum five millimetres long.
Right.
But okay. It's an indicator species anyway. So, uh-huh. So again, but it's again, it's manipulating, you know, the environment. I mean, so much of habitat creation, of course, is about getting the ground conditions right.
Okay, well, we've covered a lot of ground, Tom, but we always finish up the podcast by asking the age-old question, what is your favourite plant? This, hopefully you've had a bit of time to think about this, so what do you reckon?
Well, I think, can I choose two?
Yeah.
Because it's really got to be, hasn't it? Particularly in Britain, it's got to be native or introduced plants. And we've got an absolutely abysmal native flora of only about 1,200 species. And we've also got the most degraded landscape in Europe as well, which people look out, it's all lovely and green, but actually for wildlife and biodiversity, it's terrible. But that's for habitat reasons and connectivity, etc. So I suppose I have to choose oaks, really, or the oak, because not only is it just a symbolic tree, but it's also, of course, has the most insects eating it, which means that the most other animals eat the insects. So it's the beginning of a great food chain. As for introduced plants, I mean, I sort of enjoy myself with diversity of introduced plants. So it's really difficult to choose one. You know, I'm a sort of fairly chaotic gardener with all sorts of different things in it. And, you know, one or two friends who are sort of even one as a being a plant collector and all that sort of thing. So it's really difficult to choose a particular plant. But I suppose the one which has, a bit like the National Fruit Collection, has huge diversity in it and a rather interesting sort of genetic origin, etc. It's just generally is the sort of roses and the origin of roses, diversity of roses and heritage of roses and that sort of thing. That is fun. Not really a very good choice. If you've got many in the garden, of course, they're so prone to pests and diseases, but you have to put up with that, really. And can I pick a particular one? I'm not sure that I can, really. Yes. I haven't got time to think anymore, have I?
I think oak and roses are great choices.
And lots of lovely native species of roses.
Well, exactly.
And, of course, rosaceae, where a lot of them are apomictic, of course, which makes it really complicated.
Well.
Rambles, yeah.
Well, I think, you know, that's two British choices. That's very good.
I didn't say much about Brogdale.
Well, tell me a bit more about Brogdale. Tell me a bit more about, because that's where we're here, really.
Yeah, can I just say one more thing about it, then? Is that the important thing for us at the moment for the charity is that I said to trustees, look, we've got to push ahead and we've got to get planning permission now, because that's always the first requirement for a visitor information and learning centre. And so I said, okay, I'll do the lot. So I knew a really nice, good architect who's, you know, quite new with his own practice and that thing. So we worked out a really good proposal just for an outline application. It's not a huge building, but, you know, rather fun, and we got a glasshouse manufacturer to get involved so that we could have a bit of it glazed and that sort of thing, with proper climate controls and all that sort of thing in it. And so that's got outline planning permission. We're just about to get all the details discharged. So we need to raise money for the Visitor Information and Learning Centre for Brogdale. And that's really important, because at the moment we're just in a corner of the old ministry building, and it was called the National Fruit Trials, set up in 1952 to encourage fruit growing in Britain. So it was a sort of very minor research centre, a lot of them. But that's how the National Fruit Collection came to be there, because it was developed as an identification collection, and that's why it's a fruiting collection. And DEFRA has said, OK, we'll plant it wide enough spaces that there'll still be fruit available for the public. So the next stage is that we've got to recover from COVID, and now we've got to raise funds for the Visitor Information and Learning Centre.
Okay, well, that's a good call to arms to raise funds and to keep Brogdale going, which I'm sure it will successfully for many years to come. And it's been great talking to Tom Liddell, the landscape architect, and from the Brogdale Collections, and I'm Matthew Appleby, Hort Week editor. And this has been the Hort Week podcast, so make sure you never miss a Hort Week podcast. Subscribe to or follow Hort Week podcasts via Apple Podcasts, Spotify or Google Podcasts, or your preferred podcast platform. But once again, thanks to Tom Liddell, and goodbye until next time.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.